Today in Studio 360, yeah. When a president of the United States is trying to hide one of his affairs, who are you going to call? On the ever more popular primetime soap opera Scandal, that would be Kerry Washington.
Yeah. Your face would be everywhere. All kinds of information about you would easily become available to the press. For example, you've had 22 sexual partners that we know of. Also, there's that ugly bout of gonorrhea.
You're so mean.
I was thinking the same thing.
Kerry Washington was just nominated for a Golden Globe for her lead role in Scandal. And from our series on American icons, the record that suddenly bracingly blasted out of every dorm room and roller rink in America.
I'll never forget, I was going around this corner and da-na-na, chicka-chicka, da-na-na-na-na-na came on. And I was like, holy shit, what is this?
Remembering Nirvana's Nevermind. That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at Lookout.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. To get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, bands have to wait 25 years from the release of their first record, which is why Nirvana, which put out the album Bleach in 1989, is being inducted this spring.
I'm so happy 'cause today found my friend.
Today, we'll celebrate Nirvana's breakthrough, Nevermind, the last great rock album of the 20th century. That's part of our series on American icons. But first, the television show Scandal started off as a fairly realistic procedural slash soap opera. Kerry Washington plays Olivia Pope, a D.C. lawyer, media consultant, super fixer who makes clients' problems go away.
He didn't kill her. My gut says he didn't.
Your spidey senses aren't evidence. I've been on the phone with Homicide. He killed her and ran.
I can have a reporter out here in 20 minutes with cameras asking why you're persecuting an innocent handicapped Medal of Honor winner. Perhaps because he's a well-known conservative Republican and you are considering a bid on the Democratic ticket next year. Just to be clear, that was me threatening you.
Yeah, until morning.
36 hours.
24
Sold.
Hours.
Pleasure to see you again.
The show is in its third season, and the problems have gotten pretty over the top. Not just little affairs, but rigged elections, secret government agencies, assassination plots. Olivia Pope's affair with the president got steamier. The gay chief of staff blackmailed the vice president, who then killed her husband. But as the scandals have multiplied and gotten crazier, the show's core is still Kerry Washington's terrific performance as Olivia Pope. Washington started getting praise and fame over the last decade for movies like The Last King of Scotland and Ray. I talked with her in 2012, just as Scandal premiered.
The show is actually inspired by a real-life woman named Judy Smith who does this work. And while the personal life of Olivia Pope is far more complicated than Judy's personal life, Judy used to work in the White House. She worked in the first Bush White House. And you never know who's going to walk in the door because crisis management is, you know, we can handle a crisis whether it has to do with somebody in sports or entertainment or a politician or a union or a CEO. I mean, her client list spans the spectrum.
As you say, she's represented people like Monica Lewinsky, Michael Vick, mm-hmm. also Larry Craig, the anti-gay rights senator who was arrested in the Minneapolis airport bathroom.
Tapping his feet around.
Uh-huh. Had a wide stance,
yes,
as I recall.
Yes, that's correct. Your
character has iffy clients who aren't necessarily easy either for that character or the audience to immediately identify with. And she herself, interestingly, kind of bends the rules, threatens people, as we heard in that clip opening with media exposure. I want to play another clip where she becomes even harder to love in a conventional way. You're talking to a young woman who's alleging that she had an affair with the president for whom she's worked.
Amanda, it would be a mistake to think there will be no consequences to you telling lies about the president.
How do you know my name? Who are you?
My name is Olivia Pope. And I want to be clear, I'm not here in any official capacity. I'm only here to warn you because you should know what could happen. It could become hard for you to find employment. Your face would be everywhere. People would associate you with a sex scandal. All kinds of information about you would easily become available to the press. For example, you've had 22 sexual partners that we know of. Also, there's that ugly bout of gonorrhea. And your family. Your mother's mental illness, a psychotic break, 2 years at Bedford Hospital. I bet that's private. She runs a daycare now, right?
He told me he loved me. He gave me this dog.
See, it's those kind of lies that could hurt you if you said them to other people, people not as nice as me. I'll give you some free advice. Hand in your resignation, then pack up your dog and your things, get in your car and go. Find a small city, Minneapolis maybe, or Denver. Get a little job, meet a boring boy, make some friends. Because in this town, your career is over. You're done.
Why are you doing this to me? I'm a good person.
You know who else was a good person? Monica Lewinsky. And she was telling the truth, but she still got destroyed.
You're so mean.
I was thinking the same thing.
Wow.
You know, I think what's really interesting, though, is that I think when Olivia does stuff like that, she's not lying. You know, she's actually always saying, this is what could happen, and I'm trying to make the situation better for everyone involved. It could be worse for this girl if she sticks around and... yeah.
But is the big idea for the show that even a good guy, which you are in this program, has to sometimes do morally questionable things to be good?
I think actually the big idea is that people are complicated and that human beings are complex and messy, and that seldom in life is the good guy all good and the bad guy all bad. And I think one of the things that Olivia's committed to is the idea that everybody deserves a shot.
Yeah, and it's so relatively rare in entertainment and on television to have the grays, the moral ambiguities, so kind of foregrounded as you're doing here.
In her personal life, she is much more torn and confused and is not so clear and put together. So even that for me as an actor is really fun to think about, who is this person who, like so many of us, has one performance that they show to the world and a very different identity behind closed doors.
Although you're perfectly put together in all phases of your life, aren't you?
Kerry Washington, absolutely. But,
yeah,
you know,
you
Olivia is...
No issues, no weirdness,
never.
Right?
No, and lots of therapy bills to prove it.
I missed Ray, in which you became a movie star when it first came out. But then I watched The Last King of Scotland, having never heard of you, not knowing you. You played Kay, one of Idi Amin's wives, who falls in love with and gets pregnant by this young Scottish doctor played by James McAvoy. I was utterly blown away by your performance, and I want to play a little bit of what blew me away.
I have to get it out of me. He will kill me, Nicholas. I have to get it out. What are we going to do?
I don't know.
I don't want you to do it. Please, you are a doctor. I know you can do it. I know you can do it,
no,
Nicholas.
No, we can't! I can't do that! This isn't some simple procedure. It has to be done under clinical conditions.
If you don't do something now, I'm going to have to find a place to go. I'm going to have to get it done in one of the villages. Is that what you want,
no,
Nicholas?
No, you don't. Come here. Whatever you do, you don't do that, right? I'm going to sort something out. Just promise me you'll stay in the house. Please promise me you'll stay in the house.
Promise me this is going to be all right.
I promise. We'll do it first thing in the morning.
That's James McAvoy and Kerry Washington in the great film The Last King of Scotland. I watched that. I thought, wow, who is this great African actress they've gotten? Honestly, what kind of research or vocal coaching or whatever did you have to do that?
Forest Whitaker and I worked with the same
accent coach in Los Angeles before we left for Uganda. And that was really helpful because being that in real life, Kay Amin and Idi Amin were from the same tribe in Uganda, uh-huh. we wanted to kind of have the same approach to learning the accent. And I'd never been to the continent of Africa before. And there's this very complicated negotiation that you have as an African-American going back. Even the fact that I would say going back. I think I had always been really intimidated by navigating what that would be like for me. And so I had never been. And going with the job of just saying, you know, none of that matters. Your job is to get off the plane and just be an African gave me a real freedom to just embrace this culture and this identity.
You grew up in New York City in the Bronx at a moment when the Bronx was synonymous with urban decay and failure, mm-hmm. bonfire of the vanities. Mm-hmm. But your life was not particularly difficult or squalid, was it?
I think a big part, if I'm honest with myself, a big part of why I'm fascinated by seeing the ways that our socioeconomics and our cultural background influence who we are psychologically, I think all of that has to do with the fact that from a very young age, from the age of 11, I started commuting from the Bronx to the Upper East Side because I went to a private school in Manhattan called Spence.
And which is like the gossip girliest private school in Manhattan, essentially.
I wouldn't say that, but it is one of those schools that, in that inter-school world. Yeah. I from a very young age had to start navigating the difference between, you know, what my community looked like at 7 in the morning and what my community looked like at 7 at night. And I had parents that really encouraged me to feel at home in both places and to learn how to be kind of bicultural, if you will.
And your parents were both were successful middle-class people.
Yeah, working middle-class. My mom's a retired professor. My dad's a real estate broker.
So you never, as an adolescent, had this sense of, oh, I have to be this way on the East Side, I can be this way at home, or were you just...
No, I do think, even to this day, you can tell when I've been on the phone with my cousins from the Bronx. You know, there's a different kind of musicality to the way I'm talking when I'm with them. So there are little ways that I would, you know, kind of be at home in different places, but I think that the kind of core values of who I was remained consistent.
Kerry Washington, thanks so much.
It's such a delight. I'm so glad we could finally do this.
Me too. Kerry Washington is the star of Scandal. The third season picks up next month. Coming next, we remember the 90s rock music icon.
If rock is the last great invention of the industrial era in the United States, Nirvana is the last great invention of rock and roll.
Nirvana's Nevermind. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people. Created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at Lookout.com.
New Year's resolutions.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. All last year, we monitored the work of four listeners who'd made creative New Year's resolutions. And we're looking for four new listeners to champion during 2014. We've got hundreds of resolutions already posted on our website. One listener named Hillary Mankowski wants to make an item every week for her Etsy store. She writes, "I rarely have time to shower, let alone make art." So what's your resolution? Go to studio360.org and tell us in the comments section or leave us a voicemail at 646-580-0360. Again, that's 646-580-0360. The deadline is Sunday at midnight Eastern Time. We'll pick four brave resolution makers, and we'll introduce the first one to you next week.
I want to show you something new this year. I know just what I want to do this year. I want to give me up to you. I want to give me up to you.
This April, the band Nirvana is being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's been 25 years since their first album, a gnarly piece of late punk called Bleach. But it was their second album from 1991 that made them famous. Even the cover was great. It had a naked baby swimming toward a dollar bill dangling on a fish hook. The album was Nevermind. It pushed Michael Jackson off the top of the sales chart and became a defining cultural artifact for Generation X. As part of our series on American icons, we asked Trey Kay to figure out whether Nirvana's Nevermind saved rock and roll or killed it off.
In 1991, I was watching MTV at my friend Hank's apartment. I couldn't afford cable at the time. We were having a beer and chatting through videos of hair metal bands. Something new came on that I hadn't heard before. And Hank said,
"This is the biggest band in the country."
I said, "You mean on college radio charts?"
"No, man. I mean, this little band has knocked Michael Jackson off the top of the charts."
In the fall of 1991, Smells Like Teen Spirit was everywhere. On MTV, on the radio, and on the sound system at a roller rink in Greenwood, Texas, where a 10-year-old kid named Ben Queller got his socks knocked off.
I'll never forget, I was going around this corner, and da-na-na, chicka-chicka, da-na-na-na-na-na, came on. And I was like, holy shit, what is this? And I literally had to pull over to the side and just hold onto the side wall. And I listened to the whole song, and it just blew me away. And I immediately went back to the DJ and asked him what it was. And he's like, "Oh, it's this new band, Nirvana." And I went to Hastings the next day, the local record shop, and bought the record.
Nirvana's Nevermind went number one in January 1992. It seemed like everyone, from college students to guys in suits to Gulf War vets, had an itch, and Nirvana was scratching it. It had been a long time since a rock record had made a splash that big.
When Nevermind came out, rock and roll was certainly not at its peak.
That's Danny Goldberg, a music executive who managed Nirvana.
By the end of the 80s, there were a lot of other kinds of music that were more popular. You had a certain kind of pop music like Michael Jackson, Madonna, and Prince, pop R&B music that was just bigger than any rock bands.
Not to mention Garth Brooks, who brought country music to a mainstream audience. And hip hop.
How to survive in South Central? A place where busting the gap is fundamental. No, you can't find it.
In 1991, hip hop seemed ready to unseat rock as America's global style, with records like Ice Cube's Death Certificate and The Low End Theory by A Tribe Called Quest.
And rock and roll was sort of on a downward slope that seemed to a lot of people that were looking at the culture inevitable and permanent. People had seen that happen with jazz and with other art forms.
One big reason for this was that rock audiences in the 1980s had fragmented. There was metal and hard rock and alternative and punk. To a young Kurt Cobain, they seemed mutually exclusive. This is what he told a French fanzine reporter in November of 1991.
Yeah. Well, when I was 10 years old, I started listening to Aerosmith and Black Sabbath and stuff. And then when I was about 15, I got into punk rock and abandoned everything else and listened to nothing but punk rock for about 5 years. And then finally I started liking all different kinds of music.
What Nirvana did, what nobody else was doing, was put all the different strands of rock back together. Jillian Garr is a Seattle writer who has covered the city's incredible music scene in the early 1990s.
The influences that you can clearly hear, because they draw on pop music from the 60s.
The Beatles, Stones, The Who.
People try to put us to down.
The hard rock metal of the 70s.
Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Aerosmith.
And the punk and alternative from the late 70s, early 80s.
The Clash, Husker Du, The Meat Puppets, and The Pixies. Put it all together and...
That's the style we call grunge now. It is a melding of all those other types of styles.
Stop this song.
Joshua Clover is a professor at the University of California at Davis. He wrote about Nirvana in a book called 1989, Bob Dylan Didn't Have This to Sing About.
I think there's a twist on Lennon-McCartney in terms of how the chords snap together. That was the last ingredient to go with the punk, the metal, and the indie rock. And with that all sort of grouped together, well, no one had made that sound before. Then you take a guy who can write strangely articulate, surrealist lyrics and scream in key and plays a guitar that sounds like it's strung with piano wire, and it's either going to be an absolute disaster or the most fantastic thing you've ever heard.
Danny Goldberg thought it was fantastic, but still, he expected Nevermind to appeal mostly to alternative rock fans.
I remember Kurt's big goal at the time was, he kept saying, I just want us to be as big as the Pixies. I don't believe anyone in the band knew that they were going to break down the boundaries of the category and that what had been alternative rock was going to become mainstream rock. I don't think anybody knew that.
Nevermind was a game changer for all bands in the indie rock world. Kurt Kirkwood is in the Meat Puppets, an older group that Kurt Cobain loved.
We were around for, 10 or 12 years before that happened, and couldn't get bit, and the music business suddenly turned around and looked at independent bands, looked at more, garage art music, and in doing that looked a whole segment of our culture that wasn't really being considered.
And then, the true mark of success, a cover by Weird Al Yankovic.
What is this song all about? Can't figure any lyrics out. How do the words to it go? I wish you'd tell me, I don't know.
How do the words to it go? I wish you'd tell me, I don't know. Nirvana fans were asking the same question. What the hell was Kurt singing about?
I don't mean to be really cryptic or, mysterious, but I just think that lyrics that are different and kind of weird and spacey paint a nice picture, It's just the way I like art.
Other songwriters had written abstract lyrics before, like Patti Smith, Lou Reed, and Michael Stipe. But Nirvana brought surrealism to the top of the charts.
Weakness more. Nature is a whore. Use some fruit. Turn the rage boom.
But if you couldn't read the lyrics too literally, the emotions were still pretty clear. Here's Joshua Clover again.
That theme of, I'm so messed up inside that I may snap, that's quite evident in almost all of Nirvana's lyrics.
Clover thinks that with Nirvana, the anger at society that fueled punk took a very 90s turn.
it's turned inward. It becomes a sort of psychological self-laceration, and all the anger and hatred and fury of punk rock is now turned inward against the self. The entirety of your world is bound to be in your head, sort of for better and for worse, although it almost always turns out to be for worse in Nirvana.
Nirvana's Chris Novoselic related that fury to growing up in working-class America in Aberdeen, Washington.
There's a lot of logs and a lot of trees getting cut down, and there's a lot of people whose lives revolved around trees getting cut down. And then now the trees are all gone, and they want to go after the last trees, and so there's some angry people there.
Joshua Clover thinks that the decline of America's industrial towns in the 1980s is reflected in Nirvana's music.
My account of rock itself is that it's sort of the last great invention of the American industrial era. And so that rock period is really identified with industrial America and to a certain extent working class America. And if rock is the last great invention of the industrial era in the United States, Nirvana is the last great invention of rock and roll. So we can see it as really the final flower of that era of American power.
The last great invention? Really? Well, has there been a bigger rock record since?
I think it burned with righteous energy, righteous rage.
Seattle writer Jillian Garr.
But it didn't provide any answers, and maybe I think that's a big reason why people can latch onto it or why they relate to it, right? There's something that bothers you. And whereas if they'd said, we're bothered about this situation and you should do so-and-so, well, not everyone's going to agree with that answer. So there you've lost a portion of the listenership anyway. But this, because it taps into a sort of underlying frustration that I think people feel, I think that's what it says.
And even for those who weren't so angry, Kurt Cobain was charismatic, a rock star who really was still one of the kids.
You know, I looked up to him, as did, you know, all my other friends. You know, he was our God, really.
Ben Queller, the kid who first heard Nirvana while roller skating, formed his own band, Radish.
I wanna be sugar free. I don't care if you despise me.
Kurt just, you know, represented everything that we believed in, you know. He showed that, you know, you could be yourself no matter what. And that what other people think doesn't matter. And you can always march to, you know, the beat of your own drummer.
It's weird to think about Cobain as a role model, an addict who committed suicide and left behind a one-year-old daughter.
People are so much more complex and deeper than we give them credit for, especially those that are, you know, stricken by fame. You know, he was his own person and was going to do what he wanted to do, no matter what. And I think when it comes to art, you have to live like that.
This kind of seems like the most positive spin that you can put on someone blowing their head off.
I try not to think about the fact that he committed suicide, because it would have been my dream to meet him. I'm Cadence Young. I go to George Washington High School in Charleston, West Virginia.
George Washington High is my alma mater. I graduated a few years ago.
But the dark things that he teaches us kind of makes you appreciate what you have now more. And even the darkest thing can be seen in a better light.
I listen to their music more than any other music.
This is Daniel Clay, a freshman.
I feel like nothing can touch me whenever I'm listening to it, you know? Just talking about it right now, I'm feeling chills, and I feel good. I'm happy about talking about it.
Daniel told me that he came to love Nirvana at a really dark time. It was when he and his family were grieving over his little brother dying in a car accident.
Now I didn't really know exactly how to deal with that, and I went through some emotional things with that, and helping or trying to find things to help me was extremely difficult. And like, I mean, I was into music, but it just, I hadn't found that one thing that really made me feel different. I was actually hearing it and feeling it, and it kept me from doing things that I might have regretted. I mean, I look at that song as he wants you to be who you are. He doesn't want you to be who other people want you to be.
I'm not so sure that's what Come As You Are is about, but it doesn't matter. In fact, that's what makes it great. If it makes Daniel feel like no one can touch him, who am I to tell him different? These kids are saying they see Cobain as a hero because of what an individualist he was, a renegade, a maverick from humble circumstances. Kurt Kirkwood of the Meat Puppets sees Nirvana as a quintessentially American story.
Anybody can be president, right? Abe Lincoln was born in a log cabin. Bill Clinton came from very humble beginnings. And how did that happen? Well, that's America. This can happen here. The equal opportunity is real. And that's one of the most confounding things about Nirvana is that how? Why them? Why that? It's really, really good. The avenue for that to transpire is very American. Like, wow, right out of the woods, boom, right on your table. Strange.
Will kids keep listening to and singing Nirvana songs like they do the Beatles and Bob Dylan? While I was at the high school interviewing students, my own son, Templeton, had gotten interested, and he found some chords on the internet.
Come as you are, as you were, as I want you to be.
When I got home, he was singing it for his grandmother.
As an old enemy.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
Choice is yours, don't be late.
So, Nevermind is in the canon. What other album or book or movie or work of art from the 1990s will we still be talking about 50 years from now? Give us your best guess at studio360.org/American Icons. Coming up, a young woman stuck with her family on the Gulf Coast during the terror of Hurricane Katrina, and the experience helped turn her into a prize-winning writer.
I thought, well, what could I do with my life that if I did die in like a month or a year or tomorrow or whenever, that I would feel like I'd lived a life worth living? I thought, writing. Like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a writer.
Jesmyn Ward, she's up next in Studio 360. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is still Studio 360. Jesmyn Ward was an unknown novelist when her second book, Salvage the Bones, won the National Book Award in 2011. She's recently published a memoir called The Men We Reaped that ended up on a lot of best of 2013 lists. Both books look closely at the rough parts of life in a little town on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. In Salvage the Bones, she calls this town Bois Sauvage. I talked with Jesmyn Ward in 2011 and asked when she decided to write a novel about Hurricane Katrina.
It took me a few years to commit to writing about the hurricane. I think that the hurricane was so awful and so devastating that it actually silenced me for a while. So it wasn't until around like 2007 that I decided that I wanted to tackle the hurricane in fiction. And even then, when I began writing the novel, I didn't actually call the hurricane in the novel Hurricane Katrina until when I was halfway through the novel. And then I thought, this is stupid. I know which storm I'm writing about. I should call it Hurricane Katrina.
And you at that moment were no longer living on the Gulf Coast. Describe how you came to be there during the hurricane.
So I was attending the University of Michigan, and I had just finished up my MFA program in fiction. But I was scheduled to return to Ann Arbor late August to begin teaching. But because I'm always so homesick, I thought, well, you know, I'll just stay here, you know, until the last moment. Like, I'll stay here through the hurricane, and then I'll, you know, drive up to Michigan, because I totally underestimated the storm. And then we didn't know that it was a Category 5 until the night before it hit, you know, and it hit early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so I just didn't know what I was doing. I totally underestimated it.
And what was it like for you and your family as you experienced it?
It was terrifying. It was, you know, my mom lives in a trailer, which you can never stay in trailers during a hurricane. So we spent the night at my grandmother's house. And then when we woke up at like 6, 7 a.m., the storm was there. And then all of a sudden, water was inside the house, and her house had never flooded before. And we'd been over there, you know, for like countless, you know, sort of hurricanes, lesser storms. Mm-hmm. And then the water rose very, very quickly. And the water rose so quickly that we were afraid that we would drown inside the house. And we didn't want to climb into the attic because we didn't want to climb into the attic and drown. So we actually had to leave the house during the middle of the storm. And a lot of our cars were washed away. So we got into the trucks that had escaped the flood. And we were trying to make it to the local church, but we weren't able to make it there. And so we actually sat in a field, a high field, for a large portion of the storm until the water receded enough so that we could drive a little further. But still then we couldn't get to the church. And some of us were rescued by some neighbors that had a boat. Some of us were able to make it in our trucks a little later, and we were taken in by a family for the rest of the storm.
So it sounds just about as scary as the storm as that you fictionalized in Salvage the Bones.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
The heroine and narrator is a 15-year-old girl named Esh, who lives in this house of men. Her mother had died in childbirth a few years earlier, and is a serious reader. She mentions having just read As I Lay Dying. She refers a lot, recurringly, to Greek gods and goddesses, which is not, you know, being this incredibly literate girl at 15 is not the character you would expect this poor girl in a small town in the Gulf Coast to be. Was that part of who she would be for you from the beginning?
When I sort of discovered, I knew that she would be reading over the summer. Like, I knew that she read, because I figured that she read in order to not be so isolated, right? Mm-hmm. And so I knew that she would do well in English classes, and she would take her assignments seriously, and she would do them during the summer. But then, you know, as I wrote the novel, she surprised me with how much she identified with those characters from the myths, and how she attached to the character of Medea, and saw something of that character in herself, and how that troubled her. She saw something of herself in those myths, and was able to sort of refer to them to try to understand her existence, and try to make sense of what she was dealing with during that time.
Is Esh at 15 a little bit like you at 15, a lot like you at 15? How does she compare?
Because she was a reader, and because she was using books to escape. In that way, I think that she reflects me at 15. But then, and all the other, you know, in how promiscuous she is, and how she sort of sees the world and navigates the world, I think that she's very much her own character. But I do think that her love of books is, there's a little bit of me in there at 15.
You must have always been the smart kid in town, right?
I was always the smart kid. you know, it's funny because, you know, when I graduated from high school, I was, or in high school, you know, I was a smart kid who was applying to all these Ivy League
fancy
big
colleges,
schools.
Yeah.
Yeah, fancy colleges to go to school. But, like, I think back to even when I was in elementary school and, you know, and I would get teased and kids would call me a bookworm. So that stigma of being the smart kid has been with me from the beginning.
You call this town Bois Sauvage, which means wild wood, which has a kind of mythological ring, as if these children, these teenagers, are living a kind of Lord of the Flies existence. Was that intentional, that there's a sort of fabulistic quality?
Originally, actually the name Bois Sauvage, I took it from my first book. I'm writing about a fictionalized version of the place that I grew up, which is named DeLille, right? Mm-hmm. But DeLille is the second name for the town. The first name for the town, before it was named for a French settler, it was called Wolftown. And so that's actually why I came up with the French name Bois Sauvage, because one of the, I think that one of the meanings for sauvage can actually be wolf.
Huh.
And so I wanted that name to sort of reflect the history of the town that I come from.
So you read a lot as a kid, but at what point did you decide, I really want to be a writer?
Honestly, it was after my brother died. I actually sort of graduated from high school in Mississippi, and then I attended college at Stanford University, which Stanford University is a great university, but because of my background, you know, I come from a poor black rural community. I was totally overwhelmed at Stanford, and I thought that I did not belong there. And that doubt regarding, you know, like my, you know, intelligence followed me throughout my time there. And so I didn't commit to being a writer while I was there, because I thought, I took like one fiction class, and I just thought that I wasn't good enough. And I never spoke in class, and, you know, I struggled the entire time. But it wasn't until I graduated from Stanford, and I still harbored that sort of secret dream of being a writer. And I graduated from Stanford, and then the year after I graduated from Stanford, during that year, that's when my younger brother died. He was 19. He was hit by a drunk driver. And that changed everything for me, because, you know, he taught me an important lesson, that it's so cliche, but you know we're not promised anything, and that we can die at any time, and that and so, you know, I realized that, and I was sort of living with that loss every day, and with that realization every day, because I loved him and I missed him so much. And I thought, well, what could I do with my life that, you know, that if I did die in like a month or a year or tomorrow or whenever, that I would feel like I'd lived a life worth living, and I'd done something that makes me happy and that serves some purpose. And then I thought, writing, like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a writer. And so, you know, like I sort of went against my better judgment, you know, which told me that I should attempt to, you know, study for the LSAT and go to law school or find a more practical profession. And I decided to commit to writing, and that's when I began applying to MFA programs.
Do you, living in Northern California and Ann Arbor, Michigan, do you miss the South? And if so, what do you miss about it?
I do miss the South. You know, while I was in those places, this is going to sound strange, but I miss the air. You know, it's very humid.
You talk about it. There's a lot of humidity in this book.
Yes, yes, and it's hot. And I found that when I was in the South, and I think it's partly because it's where I'm from, and I have a very large extended family in DeLille, and I have a community where, you know, everyone knows everyone, and everyone's been living there forever. And so I think that, you know, that I missed that, but that I sort of associated that close-knit, tight feeling with the feeling of humidity and heat, because when you're in that kind of humidity, it feels like the air is embracing you. It's so heavy and so thick. I mean, there's a lot that even as I love Mississippi, there's a lot that I dislike about Mississippi. There's much that I hate about Mississippi, but, you know, that's home. So,
yeah. But you, on the other hand, you presumably wouldn't have become who you've become, a well-regarded novelist and the rest, had you not left, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Because it taught me, you know, being away from home, I think, helped me to commit to writing about it when I did. Partly maybe because I was sort of writing into that homesickness because I missed it so much and thinking so much about home and like my place there and if I could have a place there. It just helped me see things more clearly, and it helped me sort of, I guess, like more easily embrace the love that I felt for that place and for those people.
Jessamyn Ward, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360 today.
Thank you for having me.
I spoke with Jessamyn Ward after she won the National Book Award 2 years ago. You can hear her read from her novel, Salvage the Bones, at studio360.org. Her new memoir is called The Men We Reaped.
So I find myself back in California.
For 20 years now, Sam Coombs has led the band Quasi, along with the drummer Janet Weiss. Coombs was born in Texas and moved with his family to Southern California when he was a kid, which is where he found his calling, at a performance in the early 80s by the rock band The Dream Syndicate.
I knew I wanted to be a musician. I was just, that was the thing I wanted to do. But I didn't feel like anybody could certainly take a, you know, suburban kid seriously as a musician. You know, I felt like I would, you know, you're supposed to be kind of skinny, have some sort of hairstyle and cool clothes, which I didn't have any of that stuff. I sort of just felt like I was a dork. And I was. I was just a corn dog, lived in the suburbs. I thought, you know, one day I'll magically transform.
And the children of privilege.
I would go down to the Tower Records in El Toro. I'd start at A and just flip through the bins, go through pretty much the entire inventory. We didn't have computers in those days, so, you know, that was research. And one day this band, the Dream Syndicate, comes in. They start loading gear onto a little stage to do an in-store. Actually, at first I didn't think it was the band. I thought it must be their friends or some roadies or something, because they looked, they didn't look like what I thought bands were supposed to look like.
Okay, that was a sound check. Now we're going to set.
One guy who turned out to be the lead guitar player, he looked pretty much like the stoner metalhead kids I hung out with in junior high. The drummer, sort of clean cut, had like a button-down shirt, like he would work behind a counter somewhere. And then the, you know, who turned out to be the bass player was this girl, small, really small. She looked kind of like a hippie. They didn't fit together at all. Like, none of them looked like they... I couldn't understand how they even knew each other, let alone be in a band together. I had seen some really amazing bands at that point, but they were just in the middle of this record store, and they just cranked up and started playing in it, and it was like, boom! And it just, probably after two or three songs, all sorts of doors started to open up in my mind. And I felt like I could hardly even though I was loving the band and I didn't want to leave, I also, at the same time, I wanted to just rush home, grab my guitar, and start playing.
And the stars that you show, might as well be for show.
That was another thing that kind of blew my mind, that you didn't have to play with precision. You had to play with passion and just, you know, abandon. That was when I really jumped on the path that I'm still on right now. So that was the pivotal moment.
Let me know when it's done.
Instead of the idea of being a musician when I grew up, it was, I suddenly realized, like, I am a musician. I'm right now. I'm ready.
Now
Everybody says what they wanna say, and even when it's not, they say it anyway. Everybody hears what they wanna hear, echoing the halls in between their ears.
Sam Coombs of the band Quasi. Their new record is called Mole City. Studio 360's David Krasnow produced our story. And that's it for this week's show. Don't forget to tell us about your creative resolutions for the new year. Leave us a comment at studio360.org or call our voicemail, 646-580-0360. Sunday midnight Eastern is the deadline. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Julie Dorio,
Zachary McCune,
Felicity Sheehy.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
I'm gonna give you loving in the new year. I'm gonna love you in the new year. Oh, yeah. Happy New Year to you.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Ben Stiller isn't a daredevil, but that's really him skateboarding down a mountain in his new movie.
But then I was basically pulled up off the skateboard and I was like dangling from this arm like a marionette going 40 miles
an hour. I want to see those scenes.
I have them. They're going to be on the DVD and the outtakes.
Ben Stiller and the Secret Life of Walter Mitty. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.